This is an ABC podcast.
During pregnancy and then in childbirth, new mums experience some dramatic hormonal changes. Oxytocin surges during labour to help with contractions, while estrogen and progesterone drop, which can contribute to postnatal depression. But while these changes in women are relatively well studied, there's a growing body of evidence finding that biological changes, that's shifts in hormones and brain activity, happen in men too.
Testosterone can interfere with things like empathy, and of course we want to be empathic towards our infant, so a decrease in testosterone makes a lot of sense.
These changes, alongside the regular challenges of being a new parent, mean some fathers also experience postnatal depression.
It made me wonder whether there was something that we were doing wrong. There was still that sort of feeling of guilt having a baby that was screaming.
It can be exacerbated by all the things that go on in the transition to fatherhood or transition to parenthood. Things like changes in sleep patterns, sleep disturbances, that's pretty normal, but also changes in the psychological adjustment to a role.
You're listening to All in the Mind. I'm Sana Qadar. Today, producer James Bullen on how the transition to fatherhood changes dads' brains.
I think I had an expectation that the birth would go smoothly and it would be a really happy occasion. When Toby came along, that wasn't our experience. So my wife had an emergency C-section following a 10-hour labour. It was just not what I had expected the experience to be.
Dave Edwards is a Brisbane dad. When his first child, Toby, came along, it wasn't smooth sailing.
The baby, after a feed, was settled, but then was screaming pretty much through the night, and it was quite a difficult first night. And unfortunately for us, that unsettledness continued. The more things we tried, different ways of settling and, you know, different ways of holding our new baby, that it just, nothing that we felt we were doing was really working for us. And for me, that was when I started feeling a lot of guilt after those first few weeks, and I started not really seeing any positives around the experience, and was quite anxious about the prospect of going back to work and what would balancing work and trying to be the best support or best father I could be and best husband that I could be at home as well.
Things got more difficult after Dave went back to work.
Roughly about 6 weeks after the birth, I started to get quite agitated at the screaming sessions at night. We weren't getting a lot of sleep, and I would often not really feel ready to go home as well. So I would often feel a lot of anxiety about returning home, worried about what I'd be returning home to. You know, is my partner okay? Is our baby okay? Because my experience over those few weeks and months initially was that there was never a settled time or a time that I felt like things were stable and on track.
All that tension came to a head one night.
There was a night in particular that I screamed my head off at Toby, and that experience was really quite surreal and an out-of-body experience, because I just reached my limit. It was a night that I felt, you know, we had just settled him. I was really tired, and I just screamed my head off to the point that I heard a dog bark and I heard whispers of neighbours as well. For me, that was the point where I really felt like I just wasn't myself anymore. I ended up going and seeing a doctor, and the doctor said, it was obviously because of how consistent my feelings were, that it was more likely than not postnatal anxiety and depression. I was surprised, because I only really felt like that was something that a mum would go through. And I think that was also challenging some of the expectations that I went into parenthood feeling, that, you know, that my role was purely to support my partner and ensure that my partner was okay, neglecting the fact that my own mental health was just as important as my partner's. But yeah, I guess I had to learn to adjust those expectations after parenthood.
For about 10%, although that's probably a conservative figure, for about 10%, there's this experience of mental health challenge and of struggles of psychological distress or depression or anxiety, feelings of additional stress over and above what people would typically feel.
Dr. Jackie McDonald is a senior research fellow in the School of Psychology at Deakin University.
It can be exacerbated by all the things that go on in the transition to fatherhood or in transition to parenthood. Things like changes in sleep patterns, sleep disturbances, that's pretty normal, but also changes in the psychological adjustment to a role. Thinking of yourself as a provider, changing that role to provider and carer, having new responsibilities, even if the previous ones were particularly stressful and time-consuming anyway.
Jackie's work focuses on the mental health and well-being of men, particularly as they transition to fatherhood.
Families work as a system, so the father's own mental health concerns are clearly a concern for himself. You know, our own mental health struggles are important for how we get through life, how productive we are, our sense of life satisfaction. But it also manifests in how we relate to other people. So there's a really strong correlation between paternal depression and maternal depression. So the father's symptoms of anxiety or depression interact with how he engages with the rest of the family. It can affect the mother's mental health, but then it also has an impact on the child, and that can be directly in the way that he cares for the child, feels connected or bonded with the child, interacts with the child. So one of the symptoms of depression, for instance, is this lack of pleasure and enjoyment in life. And it means that we're probably less likely to smile or engage or in a pleasurable and stimulating way with the child. It slows down the interactions as well.
And that's important because how parents and their children bond can shape that baby's life down the track.
Definitely a secure attachment that an infant feels with both parents is beneficial for outcomes later on, particularly their own ongoing attachments to other people. Attachment indicates the degree to which we feel secure, the degree to which we feel we have trust in the person who's caring for us to turn to them in times of need. And if that trust is somehow actually turns to uncertainty or even to a sense of, well, that person isn't there for me in times of need, then we have to start thinking of different ways to manage and to cope. And so children tend to develop insecure attachments, which may well be avoidant, or in fact maybe even an anxious attachment where they're inclined to be more clingy but not satisfied when they do actually have somebody turn to them because they're uncertain, or look after them because they're uncertain about whether or not that's going to be ongoing and consistent.
One of the major studies Jackie is a part of is the Australian Temperament Project, which tracks people's emotional development over decades. It's now following its third generation, the grandchildren of the first people to be involved in the research.
So we have this multiple wave, multiple generation study that's examining what happens across somebody's life course that might predict their experiences of parenting in the next generation, the outcomes in child development in the following generation, and then also what might disrupt intergenerational patterns of disadvantage and the problematic behaviours. And what we've found is that new fathers with mental health problems, 80% of them have had some sort of indication of mental health problems prior to becoming fathers. So the biggest predictor of postnatal mental health problems is actually a history of mental health problems. And what really stands out is it's most likely to be a problem if we see this persistent level of problems that are across both adolescence and the early adulthood years prior to conception of the next generation.
So if you can reduce that mental health burden early on, the effect could be felt years or even generations later.
But the other line of work that we've been looking at is relationships. And what we did was we looked at the relationships that young men had at age 17, 18 with their mothers and with their fathers and with their friends. And we looked at the qualities of those relationships and whether they predicted outcomes postnatally in mental health. And what we found was that the trust that a young man has with his mother and with his friends predicted protection against mental health problems postnatally, and communication that those young men had with their fathers was protective against mental health problems postnatally, such that we had, I think it's between 5 and 7 percentage point reductions in postnatal mental health if there was good communication with fathers and good trust with mothers and with peers.
But why would it be communication with mothers and trust with fathers and not the other way around or both ways?
We can only really speculate on why this might be the case. And we talked about attachment earlier, and we think that maybe that's one of the reasons with regard to the trust with mothers, primarily because mothers are the primary attachment figures as we grow up. And that's just traditionally what's happened. It doesn't necessarily have to be that way, that mothers are the primary attachment figure, but that's the way we generally operate within our society. And what happens is when a primary attachment figure, when the person who is caring for us most has trust in us, they're actually trusting us to develop in our own way, to be autonomous. They're instilling a message in us that what you do in your world, the decisions that you make, the way you move forward and go on to care for other people, you're doing that well. I trust you to do that. I believe in you. And it instills a confidence, a self-representation of someone who will be able to care for the next generation and to care for yourself as well. And so those sorts of things are going to be incredibly protective when you become a new parent.
As for the communication with dads,
poor communication can be a problem. Typically, there can be an issue around the socialisation of men to not emotionally disclose the things that are challenging, the things that make you vulnerable, the things that are distressing, the things that for some reason will be understood as a weakness, even if it's really just something that's typical and normal but might be construed in through a lens of masculinity as a weakness. A number of men will say that I also need to do this for very good reasons, not just the fact that they're hyper-masculine or adhering to rigid masculine values, but also thinking that it's not about me at the moment, it's actually about my partner. So I need to suppress my emotion. But if they've had good communication modelled to them by their own father, if they've had a father who said, it's normal, it's okay to talk about our emotions, to share and communicate, then they're possibly more likely to step into the role of father, knowing that they can talk to somebody, they should talk to someone. It's okay to say, hey, this is hard, I'm really struggling here. Is anybody else feeling like this?
Because I was the first father in my male friendship group, I didn't really feel comfortable discussing my issues. And I think for me, it was just because I felt a sense of shame and guilt. Maybe I just wasn't, you know, I wasn't fulfilling my role. So I think that guilt sort of prevented me from seeking help. I had people around me that I could have spoken to. And in hindsight, I think there would have been a lot of value in actually doing that.
After that doctor's visit, Dave did all the right things, putting in place coping strategies like listening to soothing music when his baby would cry. And he took more care of himself too. When a second baby arrived a few years later, there were still challenges, but Dave felt much better prepared.
So whilst it was very difficult, I'm thankful in some respects to having gone through the experience and having sort of learnt that, you know, asking for help is actually, you know, not just a nice thing to do, but in some respects is a must do. I would just encourage any dads listening to this that there is support for you. There's certainly more support through support organisations such as Panda and Gidget. And I actually didn't call any of those services. I didn't actually realise that they were available, but in hindsight, I really wish I had reached out to them. would have been really helpful in those early days of uncertainty.
You're listening to All in the Mind on RN. I'm Sana Qadar. Today, how fatherhood changes the brain. Here's producer James Bullen.
One of the curious findings of Dr. Jackie McDonald's research is that before becoming a father, men don't really seem to think about babies that much.
We have a couple of qualitative studies where we've spoken to men. One is about expectations of fatherhood. We asked men who had not yet become fathers what their expectations were. And the main thing that we found out there was that men were completely uncertain. There was a real sense of, I'll work it out when I get there. That seems to be what everyone else does. The idea that preconception or pre-fatherhood, you know, guys just don't talk about this, is the, what we heard quite a lot. You don't chat with your mates about what it's going to be like to be a father in the future. The other thing is that we asked dads about, you know, their visions of what they thought it would be like fathering, and nearly always they talked about a young child and playing with that child, an older child, a child that they would teach to, you know, if they played the guitar, I can't wait to teach my son to play the guitar or my daughter to play the guitar. I can't wait to kick a football with them. Very, very rarely did the men ever talk about a baby. They really focused on the young person, that their infant, that their child would become, rather than those early periods. So I think what's happening here is there's no sort of preparation, no visualization for just being a person who will sit for a while with an infant that might not do much, just holding an infant. Just imagining yourself as someone caring and holding and being with somebody who can't yet talk, just looking into their eyes, just, you know, wiggling a toy in front of them, babbling in a way that is important, mimicking their behaviours, having them mimic you. Those sorts of things were not really occurring to them as yet.
Her team also found that reducing the incidence of mental illness earlier, before fatherhood, was beneficial.
What happens is if we can intervene in adolescence or even young adulthood, we support the man at that point in his development. His life becomes better. He gets to move on and minimise, mitigate, resolve the issues and symptoms of mental health if we have the appropriate intervention. But then it's not just his life at that moment, it means that he's got a better second dividend of a better future for himself going forward. And then the triple dividend is that we have the intergenerational effect where we might get better outcomes for the family into the future.
So that's some of the psychological changes that occur during the transition to fatherhood and some of the challenges new fathers can experience. But there are also biological changes which influence behaviour and well-being. New mothers have been studied quite a bit in this regard, but we're starting to learn more about dads too.
When women become mothers, they experience quite dramatic increases in a number of hormones, including estrogen, progesterone, and prolactin. And those hormones are helping the mother to maintain the pregnancy and preparing her for lactation afterwards. But they're also doing something else that's very important, is they're starting to prepare her brain to respond to the oxytocin that she will release when her baby is born.
James Relling is a professor in the Department of Anthropology at Emory University in Atlanta in the United States.
When the baby's born, there's a big surge in oxytocin, and the estrogen that she's exposed to during pregnancy actually increases the number of oxytocin receptors in her brain so that she will become more sensitive to that oxytocin. And the reason that's important is that we have good reason to think that the oxytocin in her brain is what helps her to bond and become attached with her infant. You know, there's now, I think, really strong evidence to suggest that particularly when men become involved in kind of direct care with their infants, they're in direct contact with them, that they experience decreases in testosterone, and also kind of emerging evidence that they also experience increases in oxytocin. although the trigger for that is going to be different than what it is in women, where it's the actual process of labor. In men, something else must be driving that increase.
Professor Rilling's team have compared the brain function and hormone levels of fathers and non-fathers to try and tease out what's going on.
These were fathers of toddler children, so children between the ages of 1 and 3. We found that the fathers had about 20% lower testosterone than the non-fathers did. But what we also found, which was a new finding, I think, is that the fathers had more oxytocin than the non-fathers did. And so in addition to that, we looked at their brain function with a technique known as functional MRI or fMRI, which allows us to image their brain's response to different stimuli that we present them with. And so we presented the men in this study with pictures of toddler children, and we also presented them with pictures of attractive adult females. And we were trying to test this idea that comes out of a branch of evolutionary theory known as life history theory that posits that organisms face a trade-off between energy that they invest in parenting and energy that they invest in mating. And so the idea is if you put more energy into parenting, you have less available for mating and vice versa. And so that's why we were working with these two different types of stimuli. And so the finding was that the fathers had a stronger response to the pictures of the toddler children in areas of the brain that we know are involved with reward processing. Whereas on the other hand, it was the non-fathers that had a stronger response within some of these reward processing areas to the pictures of the attractive adult females. And that is consistent with this notion that when men become fathers, they're allocating most of their energy and motivation towards children, and mostly their own children, and putting less of that energy into mating and related pursuits.
Testosterone seems to be important, but the other key factor biologically is oxytocin for mums and dads.
It seems that it's important for attachment and bonding behaviors, and also there's a lot of evidence that it promotes parental motivation and likely renders offspring a more kind of rewarding and motivating stimulus to parents. And there's also a lot of evidence that it increases empathy. And so those are things that obviously good parents are going to have a lot of the motivation to parent and also empathy for their offspring.
And while we know these hormones are vital, it's not fully understood what triggers the changes in men.
We do know that when men have more contact with their infant postnatally, that their testosterone decreases more. And so, you know, we think there's something about that direct contact that's important in terms of the decreasing testosterone levels. In terms of oxytocin, there are actually some really interesting studies that have been done with premature babies where they ask fathers to engage in skin-to-skin contact with those premature babies. And they found that that increases oxytocin levels in both the father and the infant. And so something about that skin-to-skin contact may also be important in terms of driving some of these hormonal changes.
Understanding these changes and how fathers connect with their kids is important for a range of reasons.
We know that infant crying is sadly and tragically a known trigger for infant abuse and things like shaken baby syndrome. So when infants cry a lot, and particularly when they cry inconsolably, that can frustrate parents. And in very rare cases, it can lead to abuse. Also, you know, sadly, it turns out that fathers are more often the perpetrators of those cases than mothers. So I think it's really important for us to try to understand what's going on in the brain of fathers when they're frustrated by their infants crying. So that's a question that my lab's been very interested in. And most recently, we conducted a study where we imaged fathers' brains as they were performing basically a kind of a video game task in which we presented them with a video of a crying infant. And in order to get the infant to stop crying, they have to choose from a menu of different soothing strategies, like change the baby's diaper, you know, rock the baby, give the baby a pacifier. So they have to kind of figure out what it is that the baby needs to stop crying. What we found in that study is that the fathers who reported being most frustrated by the infant crying had the least activation in a part of the prefrontal cortex that we know is important for regulating emotions and controlling impulses and things like that. And so that's a space where you don't want to be as a parent when you have your emotion regulation capacities depleted or offline. That's when bad things can happen.
One other area Professor Rilling has looked at is rough and tumble play.
It's a great way for evolution to kind of help young offspring and children learn about social interactions by embedding it in this really intense but really pleasurable form of social interaction, right? So children are learning so much from these playbouts. So one thing they learn, especially if it's rough and tumble play with an adult, they learn that, okay, there's this stronger, larger, more powerful individual who could obviously hurt me if they want to, but they don't. And so they learn to trust that person. If that's their mother or their father, that helps them to build a secure attachment with that person. And we know that there are all kinds of downstream benefits from building secure attachments early in life. The other thing that children learn from play is they learn that they have to control their own aggressive impulses or else the playbout will end. So it's a really good way for them to begin to learn how to control their aggression and to regulate their emotions.
For James Rilling and Dave Edwards, becoming a father has been hugely meaningful.
I just consider it a remarkable privilege and responsibility to be able to raise another human being. I find that incredibly rewarding, and it's enriched my life tremendously. Fatherhood definitely hasn't been without challenges, though, for me. So I struggled. I have two children, they're 10 and 5, and my son, as a newborn, was colicky, had kind of a challenging temperament. We didn't get much sleep. A lot of long nights followed by difficult days at work. And I remember those being really difficult times. And I've also had some struggles with just work-life balance. But, you know, all in all, it enriches your life enormously and adds tremendous meaning.
I love fatherhood. I can't imagine my life in any other way. I'm just so feel very blessed to be a father of two beautiful children. And it's been lots of fun.
That's father of two, Dave Edwards. And before him, you heard from Professor James Rilling from Emory University and Dr. Jackie McDonald from Deakin University. Perinatal Anxiety and Depression Australia, or PANDA, provides support for parents who are struggling. If that's you or someone you know, you can call PANDA's national helpline on 1300 726 306. More links on our website. This episode from producer James Bullen. Our sound engineer was Andrei Shabunov. I'm Sana Kadar. Thanks for listening. Catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.